So if you all don't mind turning in your Bibles to John chapter 21. John chapter 21. There was a shot we finished tonight. We'll see. But there's a shot. We have been looking at the building a timetable and bringing all four Gospels together in looking at the week, the last week of Jesus' ministry here on earth, and of his death, burial, and resurrection, and then eventually going to his ascension. And the last few weeks, we looked at Jesus' appearance to his disciples. We're going to conclude that here in just a minute. But we first noted his first appearances. But of course, how long did Jesus continue to meet with his disciples after his resurrection? May I have a guesstimation?
40 days.
About 40 days, right? So you've got 50 days from Passover to Pentecost. And so it was in that time frame that he was here working and being with his disciples. And so we've been looking at some of that. And so as we continue forward, he didn't just make one appearance, but many. And so in John chapter 21, he meets with his apostles. John tells us for a third time. So John referring to the apostles, right? Not necessarily to the other appearances he had, but to the 11. We know him also as the 12. And so we have an interesting situation in John 21. So I want to go there. We're going to read much of this because it gives us some good details. And John's the only one that gives us this. And so that's kind of an interesting fact and something important to note. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't do that, but John does. So let's go to verse 1, John 21:1, and let's read together. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just as the day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire in place, with fish laid on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" It's interesting. They knew it. Why did they not? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them. And so with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So, looking at the text, a couple of interesting things to note. I didn't bring the map out. Sorry, I should have done that probably. But The Sea of Tiberias, might give me an approximation of where we are. Where's the Sea of Tiberias? It's come up earlier in John's Gospel. It's up near Galilee. A Sea of Tiberias, named for one of the emperors of Rome. It's also called, I believe, the Sea of Galilee. Later changed the Sea of Tiberias. Now, why is that significant?
Isn't that where he first met them?
Okay. It's where he first met some of them, and I'm going to come back to that. We're going to go to Luke 5 in just a minute. Any other significant element here to being that place? Where did he tell the women and later the disciples to go?
To Galilee.
Yeah. So they now have went back to Galilee. And here they are. Now, I know some will really pull a lot of meaning out of them going fishing. I'm not going to pull a lot of meaning out of Peter saying, "We're going to go fishing." I know some believe maybe this is Peter saying, "I'm going back to my former career." I don't know that's necessarily the case, but he is doing what? He's going back to something he understands. Think about all they've kind of went through over the last few weeks, last few days, weeks. We don't know exactly how far removed we are, right? How long has it been since he met them in Jerusalem? I don't know. But it's been a little bit of time. I don't know how much. But they have seen their Lord come to Jerusalem for the Passover. They spent the night with him with the Passover. They saw him go to the temple every day. They noticed the way things were beginning to change in regards to him. And then they went through his prayer time, and then after the Passover, and then his arrest. They then experienced what happened afterwards with the mock trials, the way he was treated. They were there and at least have heard about what he experienced on the way to the cross. John was there at the cross, so he's the one who had very, very much firsthand knowledge of that. Peter, at the same time, has been on his own kind of personal journey, hasn't he? Think about what he's been through. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. But he's had his own turmoil. And you think about all of that. Then on the other side of that, thinking their Lord, their rabbi was dead, all that gets flipped on its head Sunday, the first day of the week, right? When he resurrects. And that's a lot to deal with. Just emotionally, how draining must that be? And they've experienced all that. And so I guess when I'm reading Peter saying, "I'm going fishing," he's going back to what he knows. He's trying to me, he's trying to find something familiar to set himself in. It doesn't seem to me, and you can disagree with me about this on the timeline. I don't believe the Great Commission has been delivered as of yet. That's my opinion. You can have a different opinion. That's fine. I may not be right. But I don't think we've got to Matthew 28:18 and following, or Mark 16 yet. I think that's going to happen soon, but later. And so maybe they're feeling a little bit like, what's the future hold for us? What are we going to do now? I used to be a fisherman, but what did Jesus say?
Make you fishmen of men.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So when you look at the text, to me, it jumps out to me of something that happened earlier. If you go back to Luke chapter 5, hold your place here. We're going to come right back here. But, okay, so real quickly, what do we see here? We see them doing what? Fishing. And what happens all night?
They didn't catch any fish.
Here's expert fishermen who have caught nothing. Right? It's not like me going and throwing a line out and hoping there's something that's close by that might be attracted to the lure I'm throwing out there, or the bait I'm putting. Right? These guys know what they're doing. They spent all night fishing, haven't caught anything. And then what happens? So then you have this guy on the shore saying what?
Put it to the...
Throw it on the other side. Now, this is before they know who they're talking to. I just wonder if Jesus doesn't establish this to get them to think. So he says, put it on the right side of the boat. They do it. And then they catch one that catch so large, their nets are going to break. All right? Doesn't that sound really familiar? I am right away. Now, it's not John that writes this, writes about this, but it is Luke. So Luke chapter 5, let's go to verse 1. I've done a lot of talking. Somebody read verses 1 through 8, please, just nice and loud for us. Luke 5, 1 through 8. Somebody read that.
Now it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake. But the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets." When they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they sent them to the partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man."
Okay, so it's Luke that gives us the most detail about this event. And doesn't it sound very similar to John 21? I don't think that's by mistake. I think this is God's providence, if you will. But you even have Simon kind of reacting the same way. They've been fishing all night, not catching anything. Here are the expert fishermen. Here is Jesus, on the other hand, who's a son of a carpenter, right? He's not a fisherman. And he's saying, throw it on the other side. Well, very similar. I mean, they measure up really well. And so Jesus is using this to teach what? He's really putting into practice what he promised long ago when he said, I will make you fishers of men. And he has a real kind of... You don't think Peter thought about this a lot, and the other guys later on when they were preaching the gospel, and this gave them something really to reflect upon, really powerful object lesson. So they're out there, they make this big catch. If you go back to John 21, let's see. Now, who's the guy? What was that?
Oh, I thought you were.
Oh, it's fine. In John 21, who is the guy that first recognizes Jesus?
John.
John, right? The disciple whom Jesus loved. How does he recognize him? The text doesn't really tell us, does it? Now again, I reflect upon what Jesus said in the Gospel of John when he's talking about, "I am the good shepherd." What does he say about the sheep? They hear my voice and come. Right? And so, I don't know if Jesus, it seems like his appearance again is different in some way, or at least they're not able to comprehend him because they're looking at him. And they don't recognize him. It's not until John says, "It is the Lord." And then you have Peter does something that might seem a little strange. Now, how far out are they? Only about 100 yards. About a football field out. They're not way out in the water. Yet what does Peter do? And he's the only one. Right in, man. He is so eager and ready to be there with the Lord that he's like, I can't wait for y'all to get the boat in. I got to get to the shore. Why do you think he's so eager?
Because he's impulsive. Peter is impulsive.
Okay. Yeah. So you might explain a little bit by his impulsiveness. I think that may be true, right? He's the one that when Jesus, is it Mark 12? When Jesus is walking on the water and he says, ask me to come out, Lord, and I'll come out. Right? He was the guy that got out of the boat. None of the other guys are recorded doing that. So maybe impulsivity is part of it.
Well, it's just because he remembers what happened when Jesus was captured.
Yeah.
And he was told, you're going to deny me three times. And he denied him three times. And then he went away really upset. And he's been working through all of that ever since.
Think about all he's been through.
He says, I'm going to go make sure.
And yeah.
Dives into the water.
Yeah, let's just real quickly cover that history one more time to get our minds right. Understand. The night he's getting betrayed, it's Simon Peter that does what? If every one of them depart from you, Lord, I will not. And Jesus says, you know what? Before the rooster crows a third time, you're going to deny me three times. When they go to the garden afterwards, it's Simon Peter that takes out his sword and cuts off Malchus's ear. Thinking, the rebellion's beginning, let's go. Only to have all of that deflation when Jesus says, put your sword away. Reaches down and puts Malchus's ear back on. Simon Peter that ran out of the garden. Now, you remember all of the disciples fled when Jesus was arrested. It was that same Simon that followed with John, Jesus, as he went through all those mock trials. It's that same Simon that denied Jesus three times, but it wasn't until what? He, in Luke's gospel, meets the eyes of Jesus at simultaneously. Man, you can't. A movie. If you put this in a movie, it'd seem unbelievable, right? It just can't happen. But all at one time, he denies, a rooster crows, and he's looking at Jesus all at one time. The text then says, what does he do? He goes out and weeps bitterly. But you remember, it's that same Simon that Jesus said the night of his betrayal, that said to Simon Peter, after that happens, when you come back, what did he say? Strengthen my disciples, or my brothers. I can't remember which way it's phrased. But he says, you come back, you strengthen them. That same Simon fled knowing what was going to happen to Jesus. Then he hears about it, that Jesus has been crucified. He has all day Saturday to wallow in self-pity and depression, knowing I'll never have a chance to ask for forgiveness. I can ask it from God, but I can't be face to face with Jesus. Only to have that hope when it was just barely a flicker of hope, maybe all the way out, to be rekindled the next day when he hears what? When he hears the women and Mary Magdalene say, I've seen the Lord. Only to go to the tomb and not have the same experience. Remember, Jesus didn't show himself right away to Peter. It's sometime later that day. He's with Cleopas, right? And they're on the road to Emmaus. They meet Jesus, not knowing they're meeting Jesus. They go all this time not knowing who he is, so he doesn't have what? An opportunity to plead for forgiveness. And then, when he finally figures it out, what does Jesus do? Like that. What does he do? Disappears. I finally have a chance, he's there, and he disappears. He comes back, he has some interactions with the disciples, but Peter never has that one-on-one time. Not until now. Not until now. And so that impetuous Peter, Simon, jumps out of that boat and swims to that seashore, my mind and heart, with one purpose. I'm pleading for forgiveness. I've got to make this right. Because of all the disciples, it was only him that Jesus says, you're going to deny me three times. It's only him that we know ever publicly denounced his relationship with Jesus or refused to admit it. Simon Peter, who said, if every one of them departs, I will not. So, to me, this is a powerful narrative. This is a powerful situation because I've been there. Right? You hurt someone, hurt God, and you are so desperate to plead for forgiveness. And that becomes that powerful emotion. And so he jumps into that water and he swims over. Now, what we're going to read is it probably doesn't play out exactly the way he wanted it to play. You know, you make scenarios. Anybody do this? Maybe it's just me. You ever make a scenario in your head of the way things are supposed to go? It's the perfect situation. This is going to happen and that's going to happen and this is going to happen. Everything's going to work out perfect. How often does that actually happen? Never. And it didn't for Peter, I imagine. I'm guessing here. Guess. This is probably not going to play out exactly the way he'd hoped. But we'll hold on to that thought. All right, so he jumps out. Before I get to the rest of Peter's story, let me take a brief interlude. So they get onto the shore, and I think there's one other thing that happens that's really interesting. So, what awaits them on the shore? What do they see? If you get into the mindset or into the body of one of the disciples, what are you seeing? Just look at the text. Just tell me.
Cook food.
Okay, so you're coming up on the shore. You already see a fire going. Right? What else?
He's already roasting a fish and bread.
He's already got fish and bread. They get there, they see what's going on. Now, we talked last week about the significance of the fish and Jesus eating, right? How that this isn't just some spirit form of Jesus. This is truly the flesh Jesus here. Right? So it's not some spirit. And then one of the main pushes of John is against that false theology that would arise and take some Christians away from the truth with it. You go back to Galatians chapter 1. I know some believe that's kind of the foundations when Paul writes the Galatians in Galatians 1:6. Some of you have what? I marvel that some of you are already what? Turning from or leaving the gospel of Jesus Christ to another gospel, which really isn't a gospel. Right? And so he's saying this is Jesus, not just in spirit, but in flesh. All right, so he has the fish there. And then what does he ask them to do?
Bring some fish.
All right. So you bring some of your fish. I've got some fish here. Where'd they come from? I don't know. Jesus says, Adam. He says, bring some of your fish. Now, that number 153, I have no idea what that means. I don't know if there's any significance to it. So I'm not chasing rabbits down that rabbit hole. Some people do. I don't know what 153 means, just a number as far as I know. But I think what is significant is the great catch they caught, right? They trusted Jesus to cast the net down, and then what happened? He blessed them, didn't he? Didn't he bless them overwhelmingly?
Yeah. Okay.
So they bring it ashore. Jesus then says what?
Come and eat.
What? No, before he says come and eat, what does he say? Bring some of
the fish
you caught. To me, there's a great parallel here. Jesus is bringing something, isn't he? He didn't come in yet. It's a potluck meal, if you will. He brought his. He says, bring some of yours. There's a joint unity in the work of the Lord. Right? It's God blessing us with the tools we need, us coming with the effort and the trust, us putting the time and effort because we trust Him in doing what He's asked us to do. And so they sit down, they have this breakfast together. All right, any other things about that before I move on to the last part? Go ahead.
I don't know if it's relevant, but I've read that if you share a number like that, you're showing authority. It's a precise number. It's not 150 or 200. It's almost like you know exactly what you're talking about.
And that's probably my thought too, as I was thinking about it. Why does he share that? It's not like he said about 150, but he was very precise. 153 fish. And to me, that's probably the most logical solution. And it comes back to proving the inspiration of the Bible, right? In that exactness. That's a whole big discussion, but I'd agree with you about that. Any other thoughts? All right, so let's go down to verse 15. Let's continue on. Now, we're going to get into a serious discussion between Jesus and Simon. All right, let's read verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, notice the directness. All right, Jesus is going right to Simon Peter. Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved. Because he had said to him the third time, do you love me? He said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you that... Well, let me wait on that last part. We'll get to verse 18 in a minute. So, this is one of those times when English doesn't give us the complete picture. You really need to know the words behind the translation. Because the words that, when we talk about love, we have kind of one word that covers a huge gamut of meanings. We talk about, you know, I love pizza. I love my wife. When I'm talking about pizza, I'm not using love in the same way as when I talk about my wife, right? Yeah, you hope not. That's true, right? That's true. And so English, we have to use what adjectives and adverbs to help us explain what we're talking about, context. Well, in Greek, they had a little bit more depth with this, because they didn't just have one word for love. There are five terms for love. What I find fascinating about this text is the use of of the words that Jesus used and those that Peter used. They're not the same. Not all the time. So, two important loves that are talked about in Greek. I'll give you these. There's others, but these two are in this text. The first word is probably one you've heard of, is agape, is our English transliteration of it, right? Agape. And it is the form of love in the Greek that typically, not always, typically is reserved for God, right? It is the sacrificial kind of love. It is what many believe is the highest form of love in the Greek language. You have another term, phileo, that's the English, or the transliteration in English, phileo, the Greek, and it's slightly different. It's more of a familial love. Think about the city of Philadelphia. What's the motto of the city of Philadelphia?
City of brotherly love.
City of brotherly love, right? Its roots are back in that Greek term, phileo. And so when you're using phileo, it is that concept of familial love, like family love, like the way you love your spouse or your children, right? Brotherly love, or your sister, right, brother. So let's look at the text, and you might want to know these. So we have three different interactions. We have Jesus directly speaking to Peter, and Jesus in the English says, "Do you love me more than these?" The word love there is the word agape. Agape. Now, what is fascinating is when Peter responds, he doesn't use agape. When he responds in verse 15, or sorry, yeah, 15, he says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." Again, a second time, Jesus says, "Simon Peter, do you agape me?" Peter, a second time, doesn't use agape. He says, "I phileo love you." Now, to make it even more interesting, at least to me, is the third time, Jesus, the third time, says, "Do you phileo me?" And Peter will respond, "Yes, Lord, I phileo love you." Fascinating, isn't it? Now, why? Why is Peter deliberately not using the same term as Jesus? And we're getting a little bit in the weeds, aren't we? It's a little bit of summation because the text doesn't exactly explain it. It is fascinating to consider the interaction. Now, why would Peter not use agape? Maybe it's because he's not God, right? But even human beings talk about agape one another, right? But why in Peter's particular situation might he not use that term and instead go to phileo? This is when you all kind of give me some.
I guess the word agape means a sacrifice. So probably he's not thinking on that level. You know what I mean? He's more thinking, like, as you say, the norm. He's okay. Not thinking so in depth.
Okay. Dwayne, the norm.
Well, I was just going to say that because I think it, in a way, goes back to when he denied it. Because the Lord is saying something to him, you know, "Do you love me like you love God?" And Peter, in some ways, I think he doesn't feel like he rates being able to say that because of his denial.
That's where my mind goes, right?
And because he, you know, he just can't bring himself to say that he loves him that way, even though he probably does, because of his, I don't know, he still feels
he's been really humbled, hasn't he? Think about what he's been through. Do you think maybe that's a struggle for him? It's interesting to note in John 3:16, that word when it says, for God so loved the world, that's agape, right? That deep, and that verse is often pointed out as a deeply what? Sacrificial love act on God's part to send his son to pay our the debt. And so here's Peter, and Jesus is saying, do you agape me? Are you
would you?
Yeah, Roger and then we'll.
The third time, Peter flips too, right?
Mm-mm. No, it's phileo. He phileo back. Yes, Lord, I phileo you. I'll double check it, but I just looked at it, so I think I'm right on that. But I'll check it while we're talking.
Could it be just that he couldn't even conceptualize the whole, that prospect, that concept of love, and that is just where he is? Yeah, I love you, Lord. This is all I know. This is all I got. For him to not even be able to transition.
Yeah, so... And he just has an experience with Jesus sacrificing himself for the world. How can I compare myself to that? Right?
Yeah.
How can I put myself on his level?
Right.
And so it's fascinating to me, right? And it's fascinating to me that the third time, Jesus doesn't say agape the third time. He says phileo. Right, and so, and so you have this back and forth. Yes, ma'am. No.
I've always had a different take on this whole thing than what you're saying, and I guess everybody has their own. But I've always heard it discussed from the perspective that when Jesus asked him, "Are you committed to me?" and he said, "Yeah, I love you like a brother." Jesus said, "Are you committed to me?" You know I love you like a brother. And Jesus said, do you even love me like a brother? That's always the way I had it.
Well, and I think that would fit what I'm saying is he eventually comes down to that level and says, okay, will you love me like a brother then? If you can't love me like I've loved you, which ultimately, when you get to the end of the text, Jesus kind of tells him, you're going to eventually love me like I'm talking about. He says, you'll be led where you don't want to go. And then John tells us he's talking about what? The type of death he'll endure. So eventually he's going to sacrifice himself totally for Jesus. Right? And he's going to achieve that agape love. But in the moment, it seems like to me, he can't reach that. He says, I can't do that. And so he responds each time, phileo, phileo, phileo. And so I just love it. Now, a couple of things real quick. I know we're ringing the bell. Just let me say this real quick. At the beginning in verse 15, Jesus says, do you love me more than these? There's debate about what he's talking about. I don't know. Is he saying, do you love me more than these other disciples do? Or do you love me more than these fish? I've heard it both ways. The fish they've been eating, right? Is Jesus pointing to the fish or in some way indicating, do you love me more than this food that I provided to you? I've heard people come from that perspective. I've also heard people, I don't know. I've always felt like he's referring to the disciples. Because what did Peter say to him earlier? If all of them depart from you, I'm not going to. And so what he's saying to him in this moment, do you really love me that way? Now he needs to prove it. I've also been always taken aback that Jesus isn't really pulling any punches with him here. It's time to make a full commitment. You can't waver like you did before. And so in a sense, he gives him an opportunity to redeem himself. Why does he ask him three times?
Because he denied him three times.
I think that's probably it. It kind of brings that all to a full circle. It also allows him to have that discussion with agape, phileo, right, back and forth. And then one final thing, and next week we'll move on to the to bringing this study to a close. He says to him, feed my sheep, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Another interesting Greek thing here is those first two, tend and feed, are the exact same word in Greek. But when you get to the third term, it uses the term we more commonly know translated as shepherd. Episcopo, I believe. Now, I find that interesting because what was Peter later in his life? He was an elder in the church, right? A very fascinating discussion. All right, we'll conclude there. We'll finish this up next week. Just got a little bit to go, and then we'll move on to something new in the coming weeks. Again, thank you all so much for being here. We'll dismiss now and rejoin for our Bible class, or a devotional in just a minute.